Chapter 15. Helia, the Blessed Isles. It took less than an hour to pass through the mists, though Callista had no idea how far they had traveled. It could have been half a league, or it could have been hundreds. The way opened before them, like a pair of immense sheer curtains sliding aside, and there lay the legendary Blessed Isles, bathed in sunshine. Each isle was surrounded by dark cliffs, the tops carpeted in vibrant green. The larger islands were inhabited, but not densely so. Callista glimpsed geometric paddocks and walled fields among the white buildings dotting the land, along with carefully coppiced areas of woodland. Sheep and other livestock grazed, and people knelt along neat, perfectly arranged rows of crops or directed harnessed horned beasts to till the soil. They rounded a headland, and a gleaming city was revealed.
"Behold, Helia,"
declared Tyrus, pocketing the engraved pale sphere Rise had called a waystone.
"City of knowledge and learning."
It spread as far as the eye could see, all white stone and golden ornamentation. Callista saw towers, amphitheaters, and domed structures, each the size of an impressive palace anywhere else. Tiered, strictly ordered gardens were interspersed among the grand buildings, making Helia feel open and far more planned than the Camavoran capital, which looked haphazard by comparison. Crossing the city were roads and arched bridges, arranged in perfect symmetry, forming neat quadrants and vectors. The geometry seemed to radiate meaning, yet its language was not one that Callista understood. She could appreciate its precise design, but its higher purpose escaped her. One tower, high upon a tiered terrace, loomed taller than any other. Tyrus saw her staring at it.
"The Scintillant Tower, the seat of the council and the beating heart of the city, that's where you'll be heard."
Callista turned her attention to the docks. They were a series of concentric, curving wharfs that formed a broken ring squarely in the center of the harbor. Lighthouses marked the extremes of the docks, and scores of vessels were anchored around the perimeters. Larger ships, big triremes for the most part, were positioned on the outside of the ring, while the inside was busy with smaller fishing boats and barges. Perfectly symmetrical bridges extended across the wharfs, and a pair of larger bridges connected to the city itself. It was truly a marvel of engineering, and Callista could not fathom how it had been constructed if not by sorcery. However, there was one thing about the city that struck her the most.
"It's completely defenseless."
There were no towering walls, no fortifications, no portcullises, no killing grounds, no catapults or ballistae guarding the harbor. Callista saw no sign of any military presence or warships. Assessing the city as a general, she knew it could be taken with a pitifully small armed force. She could invade it with a handful of ships and a few hundred good soldiers.
"It's a marvel, isn't it? A shimmering haven in an otherwise bleak and dangerous world."
"I've never seen anywhere quite like it."
"Nor will you. Where else can people fully dedicate themselves to academic pursuits without fear of war and savagery?"
Callista had no answer for that.
"Surely, if anywhere can provide a cure for the queen, this is it."
The Aureate Savant headed for the strange circular wharfs, gliding smoothly through the choppy waters. The ship was hailed by sailors on other vessels as they drew nearer, and laughter and friendly banter filled the air. A harbormaster directed them toward an open berth on the outside of the ring, and the Aureate Savant slowed as she approached. Her oars were hauled in and mooring ropes slung to waiting dockers, who deftly looped them around gleaming bollards. It was all done with a swift, well-drilled precision that appealed to Callista's military background. Curious onlookers craned their necks at Callista as she stepped onto the solid stone wharf, and small groups of porters and fisherfolk pointed and stared.
"You don't get too many outsiders, I'm guessing."
"Not often. Oh, there are people here from cultures far and wide. Diversity of experience and voice creates diversity in thinking, after all. But no, newcomers are infrequent, and only those brought here by one such as me ever make it through the hallowed mist.
Then I am honored you brought me here to plead my case.
The unloading process was swift and orderly. With a few final directives, Tyrus left his crew to finish the job and led Callista along the interlinked arcing wharfs and bridges to the city proper. Ryze slunk along behind them, looking surly. He had avoided Callista since their altercation, which suited her just fine. Tyrus pointed out buildings and civic structures of note as they walked along the garden-lined streets and up grand marble steps. They followed a wide boulevard, passing lines of pillars, statues, and squares.
This is Scholar's Way. It rises from the docks straight up to the Scintillant Tower.
Callista was raised in the royal palace of Alavedra, so she was used to luxury and wealth. But this entire city seemed to have the same level of opulence. Every building was resplendent with architectural detail. Every square had statues atop plinths, elaborate marble fountains, sculptures of golden eyes within triangular prisms, or ornate, carefully tended trees growing from marble cubes. The people of Helia were no less impressive. While Tyrus's own robe was gray and humble, most of the citizens wore artfully tailored garments of vibrant hues formed of dozens of overlapping pieces of fabric in geometric shapes and patterns similar to those that adorned the city. Many had donned head coverings that looked like unfurling flowers. Finely wrought pendants of gold, silver, stone, or bronze were worn proudly upon chests, their design complex and symmetrical.
They mark which school of learning the wearer is attached to, and what rank of service they have attained.
Callista was conscious that her spear was one of the few weapons in the city. She did see some guards clad in white and wearing curiously blank, full-faced helms. They bore ornate halberds, which seemed more ceremonial than practical. More stares and whispers followed her, but she was well used to being in the public eye and did not let it bother her.
I see no beggars, no downtrodden,
she observed.
Are they elsewhere in the city and kept out of these districts?
You see none because there are none. We have the good fortune and means to ensure that none live in destitution, so why would we not help those who need it?
Why, indeed.
They climbed several sets of broad stairs, each rising to a higher section of the city. Finally, they approached an imposing archway, the Enlightenment Arch, guarded by more white-garbed sentries. Its stonework was inscribed with impossibly intricate geometric imagery. It clearly conveyed a wealth of information, but only for those able to interpret it. Beyond it was a broad square, on the other side of which rose the Scintillant Tower. Up close, the tower was even more impressive than it had appeared from a distance, grand even in a city of grandeur. It was easily twice the height of the palace in Alavedra. An immense golden eye, set within a series of overlapping triangles, was positioned centrally upon the building's spire, and a roaring waterfall emerged just below it, cascading down several stepped drops and into an angular pool.
I will leave you here and go propose an audience for you with the council. I've sent word ahead for a room to be prepared for you. My apprentice will show you the way. We have no palaces, but I hope you will find everything to your satisfaction.
My needs are few. I had hoped my case would be heard immediately. I cannot linger. I have no way of knowing how long the queen has left, or if she even lives.
She thought, though she did not voice that fear.
I will emphasize your need for haste, of course. Bathe, eat, rest. I will send word as soon as I am able.
He bowed and hurried past the guards at the archway.
This way,
said Ryze, not looking at her. He turned and began to stride away, not bothering to see if she followed. They walked in silence, allowing Callista to soak in the city without distraction. She saw young men and women seated in open-air amphitheaters, listening to older members of the Fellowship of Light, and parks where people played solemn games of strategy upon boards of marble. It was at once bustling, with scholars hurrying between the various buildings, and empty, with vast areas given over to wide squares and painstakingly manicured grassy spaces with uniformly trimmed trees positioned at equidistant intervals. The city was beautiful and ordered, yet something seemed to be missing. Something was lacking, some indefinable quality that stopped Helia from feeling lived in or welcoming, even though many thousands of people made their homes here. It felt cold, for all the unblemished sunshine that bathed it. It was perfect, but soulless. Callista could not find any fault to point to, but she wondered if that was the problem. She knew well that people were not perfect, and a city should reflect its people. A city as precisely designed as this made her think there was something it wanted to hide, some less pleasant side kept hidden from view. Or maybe she was just cynical, having been surrounded by the viper pit of Camivoran politics since she was a child. Rise led her to her allotted quarters and left without further word. To say it was palatial was an understatement. Callista walked through the various rooms, still feeling unnerved by how pristine and exact everything was. She found herself looking for faults, a crack in a wall, an uneven section of flooring, but found nothing. An entire wing was dedicated to bathing, with three pools of different temperatures in three separate rooms. In another direction, there was a personal library with thousands of leather-bound books and a sun-drenched balcony overlooking the city and the sea beyond. Beyond the bedroom itself, a cavernous chamber with a circular bed sunk into the floor, she found a garden terrace filled with artfully maintained marble-sided raised beds and a geometric fountain. Ivy and flowers cascaded down the exterior walls.
Are all Helian homes like this?
Callista asked a pale staff member as he poured her a glass of fruit-infused water.
Or is this just to impress visitors?
The man smiled, but clearly didn't understand her words, and he promptly bowed and took his leave. She sipped the water, but found it too sweet for her taste and put it aside. She bathed, luxuriating in the soothing waters, scented with oils and salts, and dried herself with warmed towels. Returning to her room, she found three sets of clothes laid out for her upon the bed, each of a different style. They were beautiful, made with fine silk and the softest cottons, and embroidered with symmetrical patterns. Nevertheless, she left them where they lay, choosing to dress in her well-worn armor and leathers. Those had been cleaned and oiled while she'd been bathing, which she found off-putting, though servants in the palace of Alavedra would have done the same thing. Even the long black topknot of her helmet had been brushed out, removing the knots and crust of sea salt, and her tall leather boots had been polished. She was relieved, however, that her weapons had remained untouched. A spread of food was waiting for her in the dining room, sweetmeats, cuts of beef and mutton, seafood, soup, baked vegetables, cheese, and sliced fruit, as well as a basket filled with an assortment of freshly baked breads. Callista loaded up a plate, suddenly ravenous, and took it on to the balcony. A sealed note was brought to her as she was finishing her third heaped plate. The seal depicted an eye upon a burning book. She broke it and unfolded the parchment, revealing precise, elegant handwriting. She read it quickly, then read it again, more slowly. Tomorrow. She would meet the council tomorrow, accompanied by Tyrus. She released a breath. It all came down to this. She prayed that the queen still yet lived. Warden Prefect Grail doused his lantern and cocked his head to one side. He stood in the pitch darkness, unmoving, listening patiently. There. He heard it again, the unmistakable sound of footsteps echoing faintly. This person was doing a good job of remaining quiet, but this was his realm. Anyone else might have missed the sound or passed it off as rats or an echo from the halls above, but he knew this underground labyrinth more than anyone. This was an intruder. And from the way they were trying to be stealthy, they knew they shouldn't be here. This was someone purposefully sneaking around, and that made them dangerous. They would know the ramifications of their actions if they were caught and would do whatever they could to ensure their infiltration remained undiscovered. One option was for Grail to turn around and go back the way he'd come. He knew how sound traveled down here and could picture exactly where the intruder was, so it would be easy enough to steer clear of them. Nevertheless, Grail didn't even consider turning away, and not because of the oaths he'd sworn to guard these tunnels. He'd happily piss on those oaths. They counted for nothing. He'd been betrayed over and over again, so why should he bother upholding them? Grail made his way toward the sound of the interloper. He was the alpha predator down here. It was not for him to skulk around avoiding people. No, they would have been wise to have avoided him. But they had stumbled into his lair, and now they were his. A savage thrill filled Grail, and a cruel grin split his face. From a fold beneath his robes, he drew out his curved sickle. Whoever this intruder was, they would regret coming here. Moving silently, Grail stalked through the darkness toward his unwitting prey. Rise paused, thinking he'd heard something in the distance.
Just a rat,
he told himself and continued through the twisting maze of the vaults far beneath the great library. He closed the shutters of his lantern a little, however, so that its light was less visible, though he was confident he was alone, and even more confident in his own abilities in the unlikely situation that some pathetic thresher did manage to stumble upon him.
It's all Tyrus's fault.
He said Ryze didn't have enough control, that the runic magic coursing through his veins was dangerous. There had been a time when he thought his sorceress talents would be nurtured by the Fellowship. How wrong he'd been. How was he ever to gain control if he wasn't allowed to practice? If he wasn't allowed to learn from the tomes of the great rune mages of the past? Ryze knew there were such tomes locked away down in the vaults. He'd gathered as much from reading between the lines of what Tyrus said, but his master had flat out refused to put in the request to access those books for him. And so here he was, forced to sneak around like a common thief. Ryze grinned. He was a common thief, he reminded himself, or at least had been once, before Tyrus had taken him under his wing and brought him through the mists to Helia. It was like old times, breaking into places he wasn't supposed to be. He knelt by the next locked door he came upon, put down his lantern, and pulled out a rolled-up sheet of leather. He swiftly undid its ties and unrolled it, revealing his trusty picks. He'd made each of them himself, shaping and bending them to suit his needs. He inspected the heavy padlock on the door, then inserted a needle-like pick into the keyhole. It took only a moment to feel the pins and to press them in the right place. Holding the first pick steady, he inserted a second, feeling his way. It wouldn't be easy to find the books he sought. He'd first come down here a year earlier and had been flabbergasted by the sheer scale of the vaults. He realized he could spend a lifetime searching and still not find what he was after. But it had turned into something of a game, a way to pass the time. A minor form of rebellion. Whenever he and Tyrus were in Helia, Ryze entered the vaults in the dead of night exploring the depths. The risk only made it that much more fun. There was an almost imperceptible click, and with a careful twist, the padlock slid open. Ryze lay the lockpicks back onto the leather and rolled it up. Then he picked up his lantern, glanced up the corridor once more, and moved into the vault. In another life, he would have stuffed his pockets with the golden artifacts in the sealed room, but he gave those trinkets barely a glance. The really good stuff was always locked up more securely. He spied a large chest near the rear wall and moved toward it.
There you are,
he said as he ran his hands across its surface. He could feel the chest's arcane wards as a tingle beneath his fingertips, and he licked his lips in anticipation. That was a good sign. The wards were invisible to the naked eye, but he could feel them, like he could feel the pins in a lock beneath the pressure of his picks. He sensed that these wards were old and would require some time. He settled himself down onto his knees, rubbing his hands together. He closed his eyes and began to work, his fingers tracing out the patterns of the wards. He pictured them, turning them around in his mind and identifying how to disable them. One by one, he unraveled the runic wards, and he heard a click as the latches on the chest snapped open. He grinned. Then his heart lurched, and the hairs on the back of his neck stiffened. He heard the clink of chains right behind him, and knew that what he'd heard before was no rat. Eyes wide with panic, Rise grabbed his lantern and swung it toward the door. A figure stood motionless within the room. It stared at him, a hideous grin plastered upon its pale face. With a cry, Rise gathered his power, but before he could unleash it, the wraith-like figure surged forward. Something struck him on the side of the head, and then the floor raced up to meet him.